Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is a special edition of On Point, taped before a live audience at the National World War II Museum in New Orleans. To our guests here and listeners around the world, welcome to On Point Live. It was codenamed Operation Neptune, part of Operation Overlord, and was plotted for nearly a year, relying on the insights and arguments of admirals, politicians, engineers, and weather forecasters. And on such a plan did World War II and the very trajectory of the 20th century pivot. We know this massive military invasion, of course, as D-Day. Next week marks 75 years since Allied troops stormed into the breach and onto the beaches of Normandy to combat fascism and tyranny at a terrible price. Yet that history is receding. And that's why we're here today at the National World War II Museum, in a reminder of how that history still breathes and reverberates, why it matters. And we're joined by a pair of historians and a fantastic audience. We bring today's show to you in partnership with New Orleans NPR member station WWNO, and we've invited questions from the hall here in the Crescent City and from across the country online. Now, our guests. First, the legendary Walter Isaacson, professor of history at Tulane University, past chairman of CNN and past CEO of the Aspen Institute, former editor of Time magazine, author of definitive biographies of Leonardo da Vinci, Steve Jobs, Albert Einstein, and co-author some years ago with Evan Thomas of The Wise Men, Six Friends and the World They Made, and notably a born and bred New Orleanian. Walter Isaacson, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, David. Good to be back with you.
And with us as well is Gemma Birnbaum. She's also a historian, and she's the Associate Vice President and the head of the World War II Media and Education Center right here at the National World War II Museum. Gemma Birnbaum, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
So we will talk in a moment about D-Day and expand that into the question of the war itself and its legacy. But I want to take us and remind listeners of what America was like just before our entry into the war. Walter Isaacson, memory serves, America was actually an isolationist nation, a place that had flirted a little bit with the aviation hero Charles Lindbergh as a possible presidential candidate. He wanted America first, us to be sort of out of international involvement. What did it take for America to go from that to a mass mobilization to doing things like planning an invasion of Europe and planning the atomic bomb?
It was part of America's DNA ever since, you know, George Washington and others warned against entangling foreign alliances, that we weren't going to get involved in the struggles of Europe. And that was what the original America First movement, led by Lindbergh and others, was all about, to try to keep us as an isolationist nation. And I think we stayed that way for a while, but it was Franklin Roosevelt, by sheer force of his personality and his relationship with Winston Churchill, that eventually, step by step, got us involved with Lend-Lease in order to help the British, and eventually starting to mobilize so that we could become part of a war that became a war not of choice, but really a war of necessity to protect the possibilities of freedom.
I mean, the Army went from something that was intentionally very demobilized, right? Yeah. If I recall correctly, until September of 1941, which would have been just a few months before Pearl Harbor was bombed, Dwight David Eisenhower was, I think, a major colonel. Yeah. In the U.S. Army. He was not a general. They wanted to keep the number of generals very low. You know, you had to have an extraordinary expansion of ambition, of infrastructure, of everything to get to go to a total war like that.
And you have to remember that when Woodrow Wilson, after World War I, tries to take us into the League of Nations, he's defeated, even by his own party, because people did not want that involvement. And there was even a resistance to the notion of, quote, a standing army, which is why we had militia. So it was a major act of will and effort led by a lot of great leaders to say, no, we don't have a choice this time. We're going to have to mobilize for this war.
Did folks like Roosevelt lead, or did they sort of allow events to play out enough that they could have sentiment with where they wanted to be?
I think that's the way Roosevelt led. Uh-huh. He was somebody who led by allowing himself to be pushed into things. I think he knew exactly where he wanted to go. He was very, very close to the Anglo-American alliance, the alliance with U.S. and England. And I think he wanted to get the nation there, but he also wanted it to seem like he wasn't the only one pushing it.
So let's go now to the question of the moments before the invasion of Normandy, right? Operation Overlord, Neptune. Gemma Birnbaum, let's think about this. In his message to troops, in an address that was broadcast by the BBC, before the D-Day invasion of Normandy, General Eisenhower, at that time the Supreme Allied Commander, the future U.S. president, told troops he had full confidence in their courage, their devotion to duty, and their skill in battle, and that, quote, free men of the world are marching together to victory.
You are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you. In company with our brave allies and brothers in arms on other fronts, you will bring about the destruction of the German war machine, the elimination of Nazi tyranny over the oppressed peoples of Europe, and security for ourselves in a free world.
This was something that was later described by the historian Rick Atkinson as, he said, the entire Allied enterprise faced abject collapse if D-Day failed. You heard just there a very confident, Dwight David Eisenhower. And then he had also privately written another note on a card not much bigger than what I have in my hand here. And he wrote this, in case of failure, D-Day message. He wrote, our landings in the Cherbourg Havre area have failed to gain a satisfactory foothold, and I've withdrawn the troops. My decision to attack at this time and place was based on the best information available. The troops, the air, and the Navy did all that bravery and devotion to duty could do. If any blame or fault attaches to the attempt, it is mine alone. What were the stakes, Gemma Birnbaum, for D-Day, for that attack at that time in June of 1944?
This invasion is the only thing that helps us win the war. I mean, that the United States win the war. Everything is riding on this. And I think there's sometimes a lack of understanding about just how important it is because the war doesn't end for another year or so. So there's this, if it was that important, how come we're still fighting a year later? How come all of this bloodshed is still happening? That second front in Europe is critical because otherwise there's just no way that you can defeat the Nazis. They're moving too quickly. They're too well armed. This is the thing that starts that fatigue where they start to really start losing troops. And this is also really important for morale. I mean, if this doesn't go off, there's no coming back from it. You're dealing with heavy losses in a lot of these areas all over the world. I mean, Italy is devastated at this point. Allies are losing men in just massive numbers to the point where we can't even really calculate just how many people are dying at this point. This is the thing that's going to save the Allies. This is the thing that's going to save the United States.
So the fact that, Allied forces had taken Rome or entered Rome, I think, 2 days before, on the 4th of June. I believe there was, in July, another front entering from the bottom. Obviously, both the Germans and Russians were badly bleeding on the eastern front of Europe. This was necessary.
This
beachhead was necessary. And why was it so important?
It's the only way back into Europe. It's the only way to turn the war around. There's just no other option. It sounds very dramatic to say, but if this doesn't work, the Allies very likely would have lost the war.
Walter?
Something else would have happened, which is Russia would have kept moving on the Eastern Front. And in the end, most of Europe, rather than just half of Europe, would have been under Soviet domination. And so if we hadn't, and it's not the reason we did D-Day, but I think if you look at the counterfactual history, you're going to see that. And something else would have happened, I think. We would have had to figure out exactly 2 years later, when the atom bomb is ready to be dropped, whether we're going to drop it on Germany or France or Nazi-held territory. Mm-hmm. And that would have been a decision you have to think about right here. Would we have dropped the bomb on Europe?
Meaning that given that time and place, would we have done it on whites in a way that we were willing to do it perhaps on Japanese?
And there was a more of a connection to Europe.
Mm-hmm. You know, I want to talk, we have only a couple minutes left before the end of this segment of the show, but I want to talk a little bit about the people. We talked about Eisenhower, and let's talk about the soldiers. The BBC war correspondent Robert Barr described the scene as paratroopers boarded the aircraft in anticipation of the invasion. He wrote, "Their faces were darkened with cocoa, sheathed knives were strapped to their ankles, Tommy guns to their waists, bandoliers and hand grenades, coils of rope, pick handles, spades, rubber dinghies hung around them, a few personal oddments, like the lad who was taking a newspaper to read on the plane. There was an easy, familiar touch about the way they were getting ready, as though they had done it often before. Well, yes, they had kitted up and climbed aboard often, just like this, 20, 30, 40 times some of them, but it had never been quite like this before. This was the first combat jump for every one of them." What was it like, Gemma Birnbaum, for the grunts, for those soldiers who were going to do the hand-to-hand combat?
I mean, it's terrifying. You're also thinking about the fact that a lot of these men are 18, 19, 20 years old, first time they've been away from home. You know, think about the first time you've been away from home, and it's stressful. And to add to the fact that you are basically being told you have to, I mean, you've seen that, the Eisenhower order. It's just, it's something that I think a lot of people have never felt that kind of pressure unless you've been in a wartime situation. It's not anything we could ever relate to. A lot of our oral history collection, that's one of the first questions that we ask people when they're being interviewed, these veterans, is what was it like? What was going through your head? And for a lot of them, it was adrenaline. I mean, they didn't have time to be scared. They're moving forward and they're going because they don't have any other option at that point. You put it in the back of your mind and you deal with that fear later. And you can even see in some of these oral histories, a lot of them after they've landed and after it's successful and it's been a few weeks that it's like that trauma sets in where it's like, what did I just do and what did I just achieve?
So despite having to get over the barbed wire, the landmines, mm-hmm. the exposed beach, the machine gun viper nests, and the fact they've got to in some ways ascend up the top of bluffs and cliffs, they're running on adrenaline rather than fear. We'd like you both to hold Walter Isaacson, Gemma Birnbaum, and you. We're discussing the defining conflict of the 20th century live right here from the National World War II Museum in New Orleans. More from Walter Isaacson and Gemma Birnbaum and questions from our audience right after a short break. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point Live.
He's the funky woogie bugle boy of Company B.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
I'm David Folkenflik here with a live audience at the National World War II Museum in New Orleans, and this is On Point Live. We're looking back at the Second World War as the 75th anniversary of D-Day approaches. We're doing it with a pair of historians, the author, journalist, and big thinker Walter Isaacson and Gemma Birnbaum. She's a historian right here at the museum that leads its educational outreach initiatives. I want to start this segment by bringing to life a little bit some of what you do here at the museum with your oral histories. And I want to hear from somebody who himself was one of those frontline soldiers who had to confront the Germans and confront his own fear on the beaches of Normandy. Lieutenant Arthur Staymates was 19 years old when he stormed the beaches. He later fought in Paris and in Bastogne during the Battle of the Bulge. Here he describes what it was like exiting the landing crafts in the first wave on D-Day.
Before we hit the beach, there was machine guns up on both sides of the hill up the top. The boat front is right here, and it's just going, drrr, drrr, drrr. And if you try to go down when they open that thing, they're going to just mow you down. So the guys are looking at me and saying, oh my goodness, what are we going to do about this? I said, this is a matter of life and death, and this is not military orders. Every guy do what he thinks right. I'm going over the side. So most of our guys agreed and went over the side. The ones who didn't got shot right on the way down the plank. And somehow, as a kid that doesn't know any better, you do it because you feel it. You have to do it. It's, no, we're not playing football or basketball or something here. This thing's for keeps. And when you learn that, you're starting to become a soldier.
Arthur Stamets passed away at the age of 92 on April 23rd, 2017. That part of the oral history archives here at the National Museum of World War II History. Jenna Birnbaum, your historian here, to my right here in this incredible hall, right near an RAF Spitfire up to my upper right, and the soaring from the ceiling here, there's a German anti-aircraft artillery that I believe was captured, and there's, of course, a Higgins boat on which a lot of the young soldiers were ferried, the Allied soldiers, to go to the beaches there. What did these guys have to do once they hit the beach?
Run. they have to move inland. So, I mean, we talk about the Higgins boat, and one of the things I just I think is so important about it is it makes what they have to do easier. The only reason this amphibious invasion is even possible is because of these boats, because they're actually brought directly to the beach instead of having to swim gosh knows how long once they get there.
These are essentially fairly flat-bottomed mm-hmm. and invented here in New Orleans.
They're invented here in New Orleans. So what they really have to do when... It's hard because I think a lot of them didn't even really understand exactly what they were doing once they got there. They knew they had to take back these beaches. They knew they had to confront the Germans. A lot of them, like you mentioned earlier, have to engage in hand-to-hand combat to do so. And I think one of the things that was not totally clear, at least in the beginning, was just how long these battles will go on. That this invasion took days, if not weeks, to really actually be successful. So they land, everybody celebrates, but then there's days and days of just incredibly brutal and bloody fighting to make sure that they're capturing these beaches, to capture any roads inland, causeways, everything that could lead to where they need to go. And I keep saying it's bloody, but I mean this is the reality. Germans come incredibly heavily armed. There's a lot of them. And I don't necessarily think a lot of these guys knew that this is what they were exactly walking into.
This was meticulously planned, the better part of a year. You have some of the greatest military minds, not only of the moment, but of that era. And at the same time, it seems to me in reading things, particularly in preparing for this show tonight, that guys are forced to improvise all over. Like, a lot of folks weren't able to land precisely where they wanted because of waves, because of winds, and then things weren't as they were predicted to be, which is understandable, but is really problematic when you have an expedition of that size, right?
I mean, that's war, though. You can do the best you can to plan for it. You can think of every single scenario through your mind. You can practice. You can delay. I mean, it was delayed because of weather once, at least. And at the end of... You have to make a decision to go. So they make this decision to go, and it's like like he says in the oral history, you have to improvise. Life gets in the way, even in the best of circumstances. So when you're talking about something this complex, no matter how much you plan, it was never going to go exactly the way that they thought it would.
So Walter Isaacson, this is a moment, and it occurred to me only in days leading up to this, and thinking about talking with you about this and the way in which you study sort of how American power grows and changes, that in some ways this is the moment, D-Day, at which the British, it feels to me, are handing the keys of the car over to the Yankees and saying, you know what, not only do we need you, but you're going to have the keys of the car for a long time.
In the first half of the 20th century, we saw the retreat of the British Empire. And it's on, Churchill is still trying to keep it there, but it's clear at this point the torch of freedom is going to be passed to the United States, which is going to become the indispensable nation, both in terms of technology, in terms of weaponry, and in terms of manpower. And in the end, you have Eisenhower leading the D-Day invasion. Not the French, not the English, even though they're coming across the English Channel.
And there were Canadians and other, of course, Australians were part of the British forces as well. But really that Churchill had to acknowledge he would be the junior partner, and that would be what America played and the role that Britain played in times that ensued.
And I think it was probably pretty hard for Churchill to be the supporting actor in this, given who Churchill was. But he had a real bond with Franklin Roosevelt, And I think that he tries, as the war goes on and after the war, to keep the British Empire together, to keep the sun from setting on it, as he would say. But by that point, it's so clear, and D-Day is probably the moment when it happens, is that when America makes it into the American century.
One of the things that seems to me lastingly fascinating about World War II is the post-war period. We're not done with the war yet, but nonetheless, in thinking about that and thinking sort of almost reverse engineering what values we associate with the war and what meaning we take from it and lessons, is the way in which the U.S. sets up and leads the creation of institutions that span countries, that, you know, there was Wilson's very idealistic League of Nations. Everybody will join and somehow we'll work it all out. And the U.S., with the Marshall Plan, funding the reconstruction of Europe and Japan and other countries, with NATO, with the U.N., there are a series of, and certain lending things, there are a series of institutions designed to propel American values and certainly American interests, but it seems to me stability and peace as well.
And they're the most unselfish, least sorted acts in history, which is the United States, and the new pavilion here will show it, doing the Marshall Plan, doing the World Bank, doing everything from Radio Free Europe to try to have a new order. And it is a burst of creativity, the like of which we have never seen before. In fact, the creation of things like NATO and the United Nations and the World Bank and the European Union, these are all things that we're still trying to rely on and hold together, especially the European Union. But even NATO, we try to use it in Afghanistan. And I think we should look back at the greatness of these people, because in our generation, we've not created the new institutions that are needed for the 21st century. We're still relying on what they did in the 1940s. And if I may do a quick correction, I did say it was 2 years after D-Day that the bomb was dropped. It was 1 year, so I want to put that on the record.
You got it. Although, who knows, it may have been a longer war than that. Not to be too smug about where America was at that time. We had our own questions, our own hypocrisies to deal with as well. Retired Army Captain Joseph Hairston was one of the first African-American officers commissioned to serve in the segregated 92nd Infantry Division, the only African-American infantry division to see combat in Europe. He said during his oral history interview that he doesn't remember a lot of the discrimination directed toward him growing up in Pittsburgh in the 1920s and 30s, but once he joined the service, he learned that tradition dictated that Southern officers should command African-American troops because, or so the thinking went, they would better understand the soldiers they had to lead.
And that persisted through the war, the thought that black troops just were not fully capable of being good soldiers. It was the policy in the 92nd Division that no black officer should be senior to a white officer, so you wouldn't command. I, unfortunately, growing up as I did with little exposure to great racism, I didn't really know how to be sufficiently servile, and I could do nothing right, and I could see my career going down this tube.
Jim and Birnbaum, how did what African-American soldiers experience abroad and their thinking about what World War II ended up being for affect social change here at home subsequent to the war?
You know, Stephen Ambrose wrote about this a lot, that, you know, we fight the world's most infamous racist with a segregated army, that it's the ultimate irony that there are these men and women who are putting their lives on the line, and then they come back and they are treated probably worse than they have been in a really long time. But they've seen the way that it can be. They've seen that there's a better way to live. And so I think it's probably one of the most critical moments. You know, we talk about the civil rights movement as if it begins in 1954 with Brown v. Board of Ed, and it ends when Martin Luther King is assassinated. And that's the civil rights movement as we teach it in schools. And there's this whole entire part that's missing between 1945 and 1954 where all of this change is starting to really take place and to be fought for. You know, the Army desegregates in 1948, and that's a really hard-fought victory for African Americans in the military. So it doesn't just start in 1954. And it, you know, one of the things that happens when a lot of these African American veterans soldiers come back is, you know, there's POW camps right here in Louisiana, and there's POWs, white POWs from in those camps who have more rights than they do as citizens of Louisiana. There's places that they can't walk into. They can't drink from this water fountain. And then there's these war criminals that are being kept here that can walk more freely than they can. And that's really eye-opening for a lot of people. And it also becomes something that I think makes them very dangerous to white supremacy. That's their power. And you start to see just as the years go on, and it really starts with Medgar Evers, that the United States enters this period where...
Who was a veteran
of World War II.
As well as a later civil rights activist.
And then he's a civil rights activist, and then he's assassinated in his own front yard. And this really starts a wave of... This is supposed to be peacetime. This is supposed to be a time of prosperity. And it's probably one of the most tumultuous and violent and publicly violent times in American history. And I don't think that was what we expected once World War II was going to end.
It seems as though the contradictions were exposed and couldn't stand. I learned in preparing for this that A. Whitney Young, a great African-American civil rights leader, had intended to organize, or at least threatened to organize, a march on Washington in 1941 to oppose a certain kinds of discrimination, that FDR issued an order to ban racial discrimination in the military industries, the contractors, basically, that were vital to the war effort in order to prevent there being some propaganda win for the Axis powers against the U.S. by having all these African-American protesters in the nation's capital. So that was happening actually during and at the margins, the beginning of the war as well, right?
It was. I mean, A. Philip Randolph is a union activist. He's an African-American union activist who's fighting for these rights at home while this war is going on, and he's part of this effort to have this march on Washington, and it's, you know, I think sometimes he gets overlooked in American history, but this is probably one of the most influential civil rights activists of our time, of the 20th century. And a lot of the hard-fought victories are because of what A. Philip Randolph did in his work with the unions and in attempting to get some of the equity as part of that union membership.
And to note, you know, very much central the African American experience in the war, but not only the African American experience. I came across this quote from a Japanese American named Kenji Ogata. He felt called to serve his country after the Pearl Harbor attack in December 7, 1941. He enlisted in the Army the very next day. Obviously, in the years subsequent, Japanese Americans were interred, many of them in camps in the American West. But despite being a trained pilot, Kenji Ogata was denied entry into the Army Air Corps because he was Japanese American. After 2 years of fighting for a chance to join the Corps, Ogata finally gained a spot on a flight crew, not as a pilot, but as a turret gunner. He wrote a letter to his wife that is held at the Library of Congress Veterans History Project collection. He describes his passion for his service as well as his love for her in this note. In the passage I liked, he wrote, "I don't know if you can fully appreciate how I feel after 2 years of fighting to get an even break, trying to get an equal chance without being judged purely from looks. A flood of memories come whirling back to the time when I enlisted, when I thought of going to fight for my country, being turned down for the Air Corps because of my racial origin, that awful, nauseated feeling in my whole soul at the impact of that refusal." We have a question from the crowd, Walter Isaacson. Maybe I'll give you first crack at it. It asks, how do you think the U.S. involvement at D-Day changed America's perspective on our future? So let's, now, you know, having addressed a little bit certain social changes, what other changes do you think that were affected by both D-Day and our sort of dominant role in settling World War II?
You would have thought it would have ended this notion of isolationism. But right after World War II, after we win, there is still a movement. Averell Harriman, who was one of the great diplomats holding together the British-American alliance, said Americans just want to come home and go to the movies and drink Coke, but we have to be still involved in the world. We have to do the Marshall Plan. We have to set up NATO. We have to fight the spread of Soviet-backed communism. And it was hard to, once again, rally American citizens to be engaged in the world. So it wasn't an automatic thing that happened. It was something that Truman and then Eisenhower did as presidents, is say, no, we have now become the indispensable nation. We have taken over the torch of liberty, and we can't let let down the world.
A brief question. We've got about a minute left before the end of this second segment, but there is another question from the crowd that said, given Germany's warped drive for manifest destiny in Europe and elsewhere, the shattered world economy, and Hitler's ability to not only rally but solidify his base while confounding other world leaders, was there any way to avert the war, that is, not to capitulate to German ambition, but to contain the Nazis rather than get involved in such a total war? Gemma Birnbaum.
Oh, gosh. Containment is probably one of the largest debates around World War II and whether there was really another option. And I just, from my perspective, I just don't think there was any other option. I think there were so many attempts to contain, and that's, you know, Hitler comes to power almost 10 years before the United States actually enters the war. So there are multiple attempts made to quell that power. I mean, he's removed from power and silenced multiple times. He's put in prison when he's trying to, come to power, and this is a very long campaign that he's run. So I think the idea that it was even going to be possible to quell any of that ambition and any of that was probably erroneous. I don't think it was, because it was attempted and it didn't work.
I mean, we saw what happened. Neville Chamberlain tries the appeasement, tries the containment. It doesn't work.
Well, you can't contain Walter Isaacson. We're here with Walter Isaacson and Gemma Birnbaum. They're offering their insights and analyses of World War II. I'm David Folkenflik. We're here with a live audience in New Orleans. This is On Point Live. We'll be right back.
Never saw things going so right. Noticing the days hurrying by. When you're in love, my heart they fly. Bluebird. All of them gone, nothing but blue skies from now on.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair. A new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik here at the National World War II Museum in New Orleans with a great audience for On Point Live. The author and historian Walter Isaacson is with us, along with the museum's Gemma Birnbaum, as we mark the 75th anniversary of D-Day with a big look back at the Second World War and why it still matters 75 years later. Spoiler alert, trust me, it still does. Let me mention a couple of comments we've gotten, questions we've gotten from listeners around the country. First, Michael Beach called in from Maysville, Oklahoma, share how he's been remembering and honoring the stories of veterans for the past decade. He says he's traveled around the world, visiting all 23 cemeteries where more than 3,000 World War II soldiers from Oklahoma are buried. At the grave sites, he left each one of those soldiers a rose rock, which is the state rock of Oklahoma, to thank them for their service. Pretty special. In addition, we got a question from Brendan Chase. He's a student at Tulane University right here in New Orleans. He hails from Boston, Massachusetts, and he called in with a question about D-Day. He asks, during the invasion, why weren't the beachheads attacked beforehand, like by ship barrage or by plane, rather than sending in troops with the plane? So let me turn that maybe to Gemma Birnbaum. Why don't you handle that one for us?
So this is actually a really complicated question because there was a lot of factors going into the invasion. And so what Brendan is describing isn't necessarily possible with the way that the German troops are sort of stationed at the time of the invasion. So there had been attempts before to actually, to bomb, to do other things on the beaches and in the area, and they weren't successful. It's just too well guarded. So one of the things that they start, as much as a year before they actually... conduct the invasion is sort of a campaign of deception. So trying to throw the Germans off of where they're actually going to be, because otherwise it isn't really possible to actually surprise them and to be successful. And it's everything you might think seems like a spy movie or is a little bit absurd. I mean, there's tanks that are like rubber that are like blown up, and so the Germans see these tanks. My favorite is something called Rupert. It's a paradummy that they would drop, and it looks like a paratrooper falling from the sky. But to us, it's actually just a piece of muslin that's stuffed to look like a person.
So a scarecrow falling from the sky, basically.
Pretty much. And so these are the types of things that they start to do. There's double agents. There's fake radio broadcasts and other things to get the Germans thinking that they're going to attack somewhere else, that they're going to invade through another part of Europe. And so. And that all comes down to the fact that it wasn't possible otherwise. They had to be caught off guard. They had to not see it coming. And so that was the only way it was really going to happen. So it wasn't really possible to just kind of drop in there. So
as well as being an endeavor that relied on masterful tactical and strategic planning, on huge amounts of manpower of American, British, Canadian, Australian forces. Subterfuge, deception, mind games were a big part of that. I think it was on your site where I learned that, they'd announce on various radio frequencies, particularly to French resistance figures active in France to try to sabotage things. They'd say, they'd send snippets of poetry and opera songs and other things as code, but they would flood the airwaves with this, most of which, 90%+ of it, had nothing to do with the French resistance. It was just to kind of fake out the Germans so that when warnings came from German spies saying, hey, there's been a lot of chatter, we think something is up, they had sent out that message so many times it was almost the boy had called wolf. Mm-hmm. Walter Isaacson, you've done a lot of looking at technology and at espionage, right? How important was that to making sure both the Normandy conquest, I guess, the reverse takeover of France by the Allies, but also the greater war effort would be successful?
It was not only absolutely crucial to the war effort, it's the moment when firepower in war is replaced by information technology and computing power. Because what happens when you're talking about, are we going to fool the Germans into thinking maybe we're going to do Calais, not Normandy, or maybe even through Norway they were trying to do it. What happens is a group of scientists who don't get enough credit for it because it was kept secret for a long time are meeting in Bletchley Park, England. Alan Turing is there. They're breaking the German Enigma code. They build Colossus, it was called. And it was, 2,400 vacuum tubes. It is a great computer, and they're able to break the German wartime codes, and they know that Hitler doesn't think it's going to be in Normandy. And so they do this disinformation campaign, partly because we had invented the computer, and then later we invent the atomic bomb, and it's technology and science that helps win the war. There's a guy named Vannevar Bush, who was head of the Office of Science and Technology, doing both the great computers like ENIAC that were doing missile trajectories and Colossus and Alan Turing's machine that was trying to break the codes, and also doing the Manhattan Project. And in the end, people like them had as much influence in many ways as some of the generals in winning the war, and did determine that warfare would never be the same again, just like we moved from trench warfare to other ways of conducting war. Winning the information war was begun to become important.
This is a side note, in some ways irrelevant, but interesting. Would what Turing and his folks did at Bletchley have gained more praise and more attention earlier had it not been for the way in which the British treated his sexual orientation, the fact that he was gay? Or do you think this was really sort of the hyper-secrecy of the British state and its effort to keep things from the Russians, at which it failed calamitously?
Right, right. No, I don't think it had to do with Turing's arrest for his sexual orientation, because they kept it absolutely secret. They did not want to reveal the computing power that had been developed at Bletchley. And it was done by many, many people, not just Alan Turing. And I think it was for very serious reasons, including in the United States, where we create ENIAC, that's kept secret for 3 or 4 years. And that's why it doesn't become as much a part of the history tale.
It is an incredible story and side story. What's interesting also about where we are now and the ability of the kind of conversation we can have on this show is also the stories of the individual soldiers really powers our understanding of things. And the late historian Stephen Ambrose so wise to have that insight as that fueled so many of his things. We got notes on our website from various listeners, people who stream the show. Kay Patterson wrote about her uncle Oren, who was killed on Ludendorff Bridge at Remagen, Germany on March 10th, 1945, as Allies made their way into Germany. She said that she's read history books that say that this bridge was so important that the Allies crossing it 2 weeks ahead of schedule helped to shorten the war. And she's been putting together a personal history of that. Cherie Messor writes in to say that her father was a sergeant in the army and that her mother kept a handwritten series of scrapbooks that he had sent her, that she had made, family photos plus war news through the eyes of the home front, and gave them to her father when he came home. Those have been given here to the museum in New Orleans. And she writes that what fascinates her about his war story is that when he was eventually shipped out to the Western Europe in one of the D-Day waves, there were so many U.S. soldiers in Europe that there was not enough barrack space. He billeted with a family in Luxembourg with whom she's been in touch over the years, and they've connected through Facebook, and that she got a postcard from this family spotted in a gift shop in Paris in the 40s that featured a photo of her father as a soldier disembarking from his ship on the Normandy beach, taken by a French photographer named Gabi, and that a museum historian here authenticated that picture years later. A nice little tale. I'm sure many millions of families across the country have similar stories. As I understand it, six of my seven great uncles served in World War II, one of whom fought at the Battle of Bulge, another of whom lost a leg. My grandfather, Jacob Perlstein, was a captain in the medical corps there. I have a great picture of him at Versailles with his brother-in-law. And families across the country have similar stories. Army dentist Dr. Sidney LaPook landed at Utah Beach in July 1944 with the 193rd Field Artillery Group. His unit arrived at the Buchenwald concentration camp the day after it was liberated by the 4th Armored Division. He said during his oral history that war should never be held up as something heroic.
War is inhuman, uncivilized. However, when it's fostered upon you, what are you going to do? If we were to have sanctity in a world where you could live and do what was right, what was morally correct, and to everybody to be honest about things, you have to see something like this to know what not to do. And that would be good not only for 200 years from now, but for today. We have to teach this morality to children as young as 3 and 4, because this is when they form, when you form your what's going on.
Now, two little side notes about Dr. LaPook. He died last June at the age of 99. His son, John LaPook, is a notable CBS News correspondent. He did stories about his father, among which, this kind of blows your mind, right, is that a cow in the village where he landed got torn apart by shrapnel. And being a guy with some medical training, he sewed it up. Mm-hmm. He healed the cow. Now, it never again yielded milk, but he healed the cow. Now, this is sort of a funny little thing, except the people in the small village in France remembered it. They thought this was extraordinary. Why? Well, the cow didn't do anything any good for anybody in the village ever again. But they thought of it as a sign of the humanity of this American who had come from across the ocean to liberate them, and even in that said, I'm going to try to heal this cow. My grandfather once told me when he was in Germany with the army, he had a woman scream epithets to him. He's Jewish, about his race, about his faith, about him, screaming nasty epithets, and did so while he was safely delivering the birth of her baby. Which tells you something about what Americans were called on to do in some ways. Gemma Birnbaum, this museum is obviously a museum, but it is also a teaching institution. And I think that what Dr. LaPook talked about at the end of the thing, he wants to teach the morality to children. How do you disaggregate the glory of the and importance of the win in World War II, heralded as the greatest generation that did it, and yet convey to them the horrors of war and the bloodiness and bleakness that it entails?
This is a really tough question because we deal with so many different types of student populations that I try to never think about students coming from, you know, one particular type of background. So we actually work with a lot of students who themselves have come from countries where they've seen war. So for them, it's a very different lesson that they take away from this museum. For a lot of them, it's a message of hope. It's that, you know, they've seen some of the things that the people who are in these galleries have seen, and that they came out the other side. And that's a lot of the students that we deal with around the country. You know, we're a national museum, and this is sort of what we deal with. For a lot of the students, that morality and those questions are through the experiences that we have. There's something called the What Would You Do experience in our U.S. Freedom Pavilion, where they are forced to make the same decisions with the same amount of evidence that those who made them 75 years ago today had to do, just without the pressure of, you know, the war happening right behind them. And these are really critical questions. I also get asked a lot, you know, this museum is not for young people. It's too, you know, you have to be at least 12 or 13 years old. You know, 1.5 million children die in the Holocaust. They weren't too young to die. Nobody's too young to have to learn those lessons, I think.
Mm-hmm. We have a question from a woman named Lisa, and has joined us in the crowd today. She says, my grandfather served in the Pacific, in the Navy, and refused to tell us about his experience. Do you find this is common amongst the European Theater D-Day veterans as well? What do you say, Gemma?
I think it was really common probably 30 or 40 years ago. I think, you know, to Stephen Ambrose's credit, in the 1980s, he starts conducting a lot of these oral histories and looking into some of these stories a little bit more. And I think that there were a lot of people who either didn't want to talk about it because it was traumatic or didn't think it was important enough to discuss. You know, it was just something that they did for a few years when they were young. They had to do it. They were either drafted or they felt this call to join up. And it was just something they did, and then they moved on with their lives. Only now do we look back on it and we say, this was actually very extraordinary. So I think I think that is a common experience where they don't want to talk about it, regardless of the front that they were on.
The museum here has, if I'm not mistaken, something like 10,000 personal accounts. What do those do for you as a historian?
It's probably the best resource you can have. You know, government documents are always really easy to get for the most part, but those personal stories are what makes it relatable, especially when we're dealing with teachers and students. And, you know, I consider everybody a student, no matter how old they are. If they're in this museum, they're going to learn something. And that's the way you can relate to some of these things. Everybody should walk into this museum or go on our website or search our digital collection and see themselves reflected in that history and somebody that they can relate to. And I think that's really important, especially when you're talking about young people learning history. That they have to see something that they recognize. And I think it's also really important for students to see people that they don't recognize. And that having 10,000 personal accounts really allows us to do that.
Walter Isaacson, in the minute that we have left in this show, you know, it's been called the greatest generation. I feel like there's an element of hagiography as well as history in that. How are we to think of the largely men, but men and women who made this happen?
The greatest generation.
You think
so? There may be a little hagiography, but they deserve it. One of the things I love about this museum, you can look right out of the window, and it's not just the generals. It's not, you know, Eisenhower or Marshall. There's a bench where all the people are getting briefed about having to land. I see Boise Bollinger here, who's one of the chairs, and there's this new canopy that will have statues like that of the ordinary people who fought the war. My brother's here, and our father was in the Navy during World War II, mm-hmm. and he never talked about it much. But this is a type of generation where he dropped out of Tulane as a junior because he was afraid he was going to miss the war. And there's a picture of him and five other friends who signed up. That's something that future generations should look back on, and we shouldn't worry about hagiography. We should respect it.
A war of choice that was necessary that changed the flow of history. You've been hearing the insights there of Walter Isaacson, Tulane University history professor, author of definitive biographies of some of the great thinkers of our time and centuries past. So pleased you were able to join us this evening.
Thank you, David.
And also Gemma Birnbaum, historian and the associate vice president and head of the World War II Media and Education Center here at the National World War II Museum. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Our great thanks to the National World War II Museum here in New Orleans for hosting us and providing us with such a rich tapestry of material and oral histories on which to draw. If you'd like to see more photos and listen to veteran stories from the museum archives, we've put together a showcase for you to check out at our website, onpointradio.org. I'd like to give special thanks to my colleagues, Allison Poley and Reinhard Zinski, and also to Robert and Patrick Carroll, who have aided us here in New Orleans. Thanks to them. We'd like especially to single out member station WWNO New Orleans, which we've been partnering with here in the city. And thanks to those who joined us live, as well as our audience in person listening across the land. You power us, each one of you. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point Live.